It's interesting because when you're growing up with your grandparents, you don't have a label. This is just your family, so you're not, I was not being taught per se, like you are, Native, you are Chickamauga, Cherokee, we are, it's not a label like that. You just exist, and these are, someone passes away, this is what you do. It's not because we are this. It was never given a label. It just was not that type of thing. I learned later as a teenager, being in New York City, my mom said, oh, this is what that is.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. Martha Redbone is acclaimed for her powerful performances as a singer, as well as her prize-winning songwriting, composition, and arranging. For over 30 years, she's been in a successful collaboration with her partner, Aaron Whitby, and we talked about some of their new theatrical projects, including Black Mountain Women, The Sex Variants of 1941, and Guardian Spirit, The Words of Bell Hooks. Throughout this episode, you'll be hearing clips from Martha's powerful album, The Garden of Love, which sets the poetry of William Blake to the diverse music of Appalachia, written with Aaron and John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Many people think of the music, culture, and history of Appalachia in terms of the blend of white settlers in the area. But Martha's family heritage from Harlan County, Kentucky, includes African American, British, Chickamauga Cherokee, and Mississippi Choctaw. She shared her experiences growing up with her grandparents as part of a coal mining family, as well as the dramatic changes she has witnessed in Brooklyn over several decades. In this wide-ranging episode, you'll also hear Martha's great advice for self-care, maintaining boundaries, and working collaboratively. We started this conversation with Martha's collaborations with clarinetist Tasha Warren and cellist Dave Egger, and if you missed my interview with Tasha last year, it's linked to this one in the show notes. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on many podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the show notes of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including different ways to support this podcast.
Hey, Martha, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Leah.
You know, I first discovered your music when I was researching Tasha Warren last year, the clarinetist, because of your powerful piece on her first album with Dave Egger. So people who heard that episode will have heard a little bit of Black Mountain Calling, and I'll be linking that episode. But I was in communication with Tasha and Dave and you about a new project coming out in 2026. So we'll talk about that a little bit. They gave me a little bit of fascinating information, but I did communicate with Dave that we're going to do an episode with him in a few months, actually, with a focus on that new album.
That's
amazing. So I understand this collaboration with children in both Tennessee and Kenya, and this teacher, Manny Elswick, with your piece.
Yeah, that was a wonderful collaboration. We went up to Vermont and worked in this really beautiful recording studio, and just stunning. And we just played with some improvisation, and there was something, there was almost like I ended up kind of like singing a prayer, a type of, in a way, it felt like a prayer, like a healing kind of mother prayer. And we just kind of, it sparked from there. I ended up adding some vocal layers and layers upon layers, and Dave and Tasha just, we ended up making like a, what I call like almost like a braid, a kind of sweetgrass braid, of this weaving in it. And it was so, warm and loving and really, really beautiful. And so, they went to the studio in Bristol and worked on it a bit more. And then, they got in touch and said they were working with some kids and they loved the some of the words that and phrases that I was singing. And so we just ended up developing that. And then the children ended up singing those songs together. And it was just really beautiful. And I added a bit more. And then we just had this magical piece that came about.
Wonderful. And did Tasha and Dave reach out to you for that project initially a few years ago?
Of course, yes. We became friends with the first album, with the Emily Dickinson phrase. But and David asked me to create a piece for that. And it was during the pandemic. And so we kind of did everything online. And it was really interesting. It was the first time that we ever worked in that capacity. Of course, times that a lot of people worked in that capacity, you know, online and not, you know, just doing Zooms. And so that piece came about, Black Mountain Calling came about. And I've been working on a lot of projects that honor my homeland in Kentucky, in Harlan County, Kentucky, where I'm from. And I've been doing this for some time now, just having pieces that celebrate the land and kind of, I guess, trying to recreate in a way this, you know, for want of a better phrase, and a kind of ancestral sound, an ancestral calling, you know, that you hear when you're in the woods up there really high up. And so Black Mountain Calling came out of our first collaboration, and it was so beautiful and so easy. And then we got together and had a concert up in the University of Michigan as part of the series that Tasha ran. And again, it was just absolutely stunning to be a part of that project. I mean, not only has it been a bucket list, you know, to work with Dave Egger, of course, who's, we have so many friends in common, but to actually be able to spend a lot of time with him creatively, and Tasha, who is just absolutely magical, a magical, magical musician. I call her my Wonder Woman. You know, I was usually when I speak to her, hey, Wonder Woman, but just their combination, this chamber music piece that I worked on was just very, very special. And then they called me again and said, hey, we want you to do this again. And I went, what? Oh my goodness. So come on, let's do this.
It occurs to me, we really should play a clip of Black Mountain Calling here, because people, you know, even if they heard this episode, it was many months ago. So I think we should do that for the listeners.
Sure.
I know you have some new projects. I was curious, you have this new musical you're working on, Black Mountain Woman. Is that related to your Bone Hill project?
In a way, I guess I would call it, you know, Bone Hill is an interesting project because we wanted to talk about the resilience of the people in the land, but you know, through my own family stories. And Black Mountain Women is a new piece that is unrelated, but kind of related at the same time. So it's not, it's based on this family stories. However, it talks about something much deeper. And it talks about the land in particular, specifically, and the people who continue to live on this land and what it means when the dead meet walk among the living. So it's a kind of, I guess, mystical piece. And not so much Bone Hill, which was much more of an historical and musical timeline. This is not. This is in a particular scenario. And so I'm excited to get back to that in the fall. We started that one during just before the pandemic, and then came to a grinding halt and did a couple of workshops and things and figured things out. And then we're going to get back on board. And I love that piece. Our book writer for Black Mountain Women is Naomi Izuka, and our director is Les Waters.
So this is with Public Theater in New York?
Yes.
And so it's a full musical theater piece?
Yes. It will be more of a play with music, I think, as opposed to a musical.
Okay. Well, so in terms of the history of Appalachia and your family, can you speak a little bit about that so people understand?
Sure. It's interesting because I do a lot of concerts, and you know, I'm always on the road with my band, and we, you know, play our music, and we call it the Roots Project, and it allows us to kind of dig in deep to the history of the southeastern region of the United States. We touch on many, many things. We touch on civil rights songs, old time blues songs. We talk modern songs. We even dig into our William Blake project as well, with the sounds of Appalachia being set with the poetry of William Blake and some of the meanings that are very similar. You know, the pictures of this land. In fact, William Blake even writes about, has a poem about being on, rejecting England and settling on the shores of the Ohio River in one of his poems. And I come from a really small town in Harlan County, which is the infamous Harlan County coal country. And I come from a family of coal miners. And it's interesting because so many people don't even know the history of Harlan County. They only have this one documentary, Harlan County USA, which tells a major story about the unions and this kind of thing. But what it didn't really address were all the black coal miners who had migrated to the region after slavery. And so there were black coal miners who worked in the mines as early as the 1880s. That is not touched on. My great-grandfather built many of the homes for the colored people, quote-unquote colored people, who worked in those mines. And that was in the early turn of the century as well. And so there's just a real rich history that I think many people are not familiar with that I felt needs to be, for want of a better word, lifted up and kind of celebrated as well. And, you know, the story of coal mining and how hard it was for all of the people, and with unions and strike breakers and the Jim Crow all at the same time, and the segregation, and then the integration all along, you know, because these towns are very small. So all of this, it's a really rich history to be unfolded and shared and celebrated. My grandfather, this is my mom's dad, died from black lung he worked in those mines and was there in the early 1940s, and he was gone by 62 years old, you know. So it was a really tough life, and so was my grandpa's brother was there. Uncles all worked in the coal mines. There's the famous, what we call in the regional, the Eastern Kentucky Social Club, which was a place for the black coal miners and their families to, you know, have events and gatherings. And also one of my, our family friends, dear family friends, Dr. Bill Turner is an historian on blacks in Appalachia and the rich history behind that.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of your mother's side of the family, it's indigenous, but different nations?
That's right. So my grandpa came from Alabama, Melville, Alabama, and his grandfather came from Mississippi. And so they are mixed, white and Choctaw and black. And on my mother's side, on my grandmother's side, my grandmother's family had been in Harlan County and in Lee County, Virginia for centuries and centuries. My fifth great grandfather fought in the War of 1812. So, and they are mixed Chickamauga, Cherokee, and white and black. And so we are completely known, I guess, as the triracials of the region. And when you look at Indian removal and reclassification and the story behind Walter Plecker, who was the head of the Bureau of Vital Statistics, he was also a eugenicist. And so many of those states had this one drop rule, and it really affected Kentucky and Virginia and Tennessee, where began a systemic process of paper genocide.
And what do you mean by that in terms of?
So paper genocide is when your identity is changed overnight on paper in the eyes of the government. They had, you know, implemented a census, taking censuses of the region because they wanted to make sure that Native Americans were completely eliminated from these areas. It was paper genocide. And not only were there physical, you know, genocide, but there was also genocide on paper for those who were mixed race. And so if you were a Native person who was married to someone who was white, you know, your race was changed. If you were married to someone who was black, a Native person who was married to someone who was black, your race, you know, you were changed. You were given a race and then you were removed. You can see it in my own family story, where there are census rolls that say IND for Indian in these counties. And then, you know, 10 years later, you'd see that they were MU, changed to MU, mulatto. And then another decade later, you would see COL for colored, or B for black, you know, the same people, you know. And my family were, like I said, we were a coal family. We didn't have money. We, you know, didn't have a lot of money. And so you didn't really move very, very much because you couldn't afford to leave your place. So you can see how our identity was erased on paper overnight. But it doesn't really change who you are, you know, culturally. You are who you are. And your family is who your family is.
So, Martha, when you started to dig in and do some of this research, this archival research, was it shocking to see the evidence?
No, because it was known. We've known this in our family forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are, you know, multicultural families, so we've seen that. We know that because that's, you know, we always come home. What was interesting to see is the not the archival research of our family, but the archival research of the history of that land, I found the most riveting and incensing, I guess you can, is that such a word, where you just feel just livid with the injustice. And the very sad part about it is, you know, you dig deep, you don't just go into your own family, you're looking at all kinds of other things. I mean, I found letters, you know, they're available, they're all online, you know, you can see these things in the National Archives, you can, you know, look in you know, all kinds of documents. You can go to the Freedmen's Bureaus and all kinds of, you know, historical documents and see these things. And it is really, truly shocking when you look at the files. And what you do see at the end is the reason behind the erasure of so many Indigenous and Afro-Indigenous people is the one drop rule, but the reason behind that erasure is poverty. Most of the people could not read or write, and therefore you didn't, you know, you were at the mercy of whoever filled out these forms, you know. And then there is a there's a book that talks about there's a book called Indivisible. And you can find it online, Indivisible, the story of African American and Native American peoples. And you can see how the systemic racism worked. And it is really, it just shows you the ugliness of legislature when, you know, commodification and money is in, you know, access to resources is at stake, and greed. So you can really see that. And as a songwriter, when you discover these things, you know, you can say, you know, you can choose easily to demonize a system of people, but it's not, you know, it's much deeper than that. It goes much deeper than that. And so, you know, you look at as a songwriter and a composer, you know, you look at it in terms of all the angles, you try to address it from all the angles and see it for what it is, and see it for the sorrow, the sadness, and also the absurdity of racism. You know, I just watched something the other day where someone said, if I cut my arm, Leah, if I cut my arm, and Leah, if you cut your arm at the same time, what comes out? Right? Mm-hmm. Our blood is exactly the same color, you know? And so this is how, you know, someone was, I can't remember it was like on a YouTube video, I think it was like a civil rights activist or something. And when they said that, you know, you realize that we're human beings, and it's our responsibility to recognize that we are human, and the story of the melanin is kind of, means, you know, it means nothing at the end of the day. And so as a songwriter, I just try to address these things from as many angles as I can, and to find ways of showing how humanity should be, you know, giving ideals and things to strive for, and how to make things better, you know, and how things, yes, this is what has happened, this is the ugliness of what has happened, but look at how far we've come, and look at what we can do moving forward to work together to make this world a place that our children's children will be able to tell stories. Yes, it was a terrible time, but my great-grands worked towards fixing that, and look at where we are today. Do you see what I mean? And that's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah, and with that strand, Martha, I saw those beautiful videos you made for Carnegie, for children. And I was interested in the intercultural influence in terms of call and response musically with the Black community and Indigenous. So, maybe.
I love teaching social dances because the social dances of the Southeast are really wonderful because of the history of, you know, of enslaved people and Indigenous people in the region, as well as people who were settlers. I think it's really important to share in a call and response style, which harkens right back to Africa. It's a great way to teach children. It's a wonderful way to teach children to follow, you know, just to follow songs. I think, you know, one of the things I just simply came to realize when we talk about singing folk music, you know, when someone says folk music, people immediately think of banjos and fiddles and white people. You know, if you say that was a folk music festival, but they don't understand that folk music is all folk. It's everyone who came to this land and they brought the music from their folk. You know, they brought the music from Irish folk, from Scottish folk, from African folk, from Black folks, from Indigenous folk, you know, German folk, Portuguese. And this is the sound that comes from all of these people coming together in these various regions throughout the Southeast is why we have this music. The music that we have in American roots music is not heard in other places. And the same people went to other regions, you know, all over this world. You know, they brought Africans all over the world for work, you know, for enslaved labor. They hit people over the head from Ireland and shipped them to Australia for labor, you know. So and there's a different type of music that comes out of there. So it's really important to understand what folk music means. And so when I use the call and response style, that's going back to my grandfather's people. You know, and also, you know, my great grandparents in Virginia and Kentucky, this is the music that that they listened to, that they would hear their grandparents sing. You know, so I love that it's kind of translated to these children's projects.
Yeah, so we're going to be including some clips of your beautiful album, The Garden of Love. So maybe at this point, I was thinking the opening track, you know, it's so arresting and with the rattles and so really powerful. Do you want to speak to that a little bit and then we'll include a little clip?
Sure. The Garden of Love was really a project that we made by happenstance, believe it or not. We made the decision to make a mountain record, quote unquote mountain record, because we were losing so many of our elders and our community back home. And I wanted a way to, and I realized, you know, that in our family, you know, our little ones will not, you know, we'll see photos and things, but not really capture the essence of what that region means and what that land means. And so once again, I do everything through music. And so my partner and husband, Aaron Whitby, who I do the majority of my collaborations with, we decided let's make this mountain record. So we started thinking of, you know, kind of, songs, you know, coal country songs and things like that, and old, pioneer songs and those kinds of things. And then Aaron said, hey, what about, look at this anthology of William Blake's poetry that we have here on the shelf. He says, some of these look really cool. Let's have a look through these. So we looked through a bunch of them and we found so many that really resonated and painted the picture of, you know, very similar to England, you know, rolling hills and, you know, craggy mountains and climbing things and green pastures. And I thought, wow, this really resonates with Kentucky. Let's do that. So we ended up setting three of the poems, and we said, well, look, we can't have like all these different, you know, coal mining songs and kind of Appalachian song, folk songs and things like that. And then three William Blake poems. Like, why three William Blake poems? It doesn't make any sense. And so we said, you know what? We're honoring Black Mountain. Let's just honor William Blake. And so we just, we ended up doing a whole, whole setting of all these different poems. And we still have more. We still have more that we hadn't recorded. We ended up calling John McEwen from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, who had, we'd become friends with, and met with him. And we said, he's our guy. He would be the perfect person to capture this. So we demoed up a bunch of songs and then called up John and played it for him. And John absolutely loved what we did. He just loved the rawness of what we'd done. And then he added his incredible magic. He ended up just putting these beautiful arrangements on each of the songs, and we recorded in Nashville, and the rest is history.
And John plays many instruments on this album.
He's playing, I believe John is playing 9 different instruments, you know, because that is John McEwen. Yeah.
I was curious on you have a special guest on A Dream, David Amram. Do you know him personally?
Yes, David Amram. David is a really dear, dear friend of ours for, gosh, at least 20 years now, coming on 20 years. Yeah.
What a legend.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's a dear friend. We just talked with him last week.
Okay.
I believe he's 94. He might be 94 now. He is wonderful. We're just talking about doing a show together in the fall. We're going to be working together in October.
That's inspiring to hear.
We play with him all the time. Okay. We do lots of different, you know, we'll come and sing a song at his birthday parties. He always has birthday concerts in the city. And he is a remarkable human being. Absolutely brilliant. Speaking of playing many, many instruments, he's wonderful.
Yeah, do you want to say a little bit about him for people who haven't heard about him?
David Amram is a wonderful American composer. I believe he was, I can't even give his bio, but you can Google him and find his bio. And he has done everything. He was also part of the civil rights movement. He was part of the beatnik movement with Jack Kerouac. And I have a whole stack of Jack Kerouac poems that he wanted Aaron and I to, we're in our little studio here, and you see James Baldwin. It's our little blessing in the corner there. But he wanted us to do something with the Jack Kerouac poems, which we will. I'd like to get him on that too.
Okay. Yeah, I worked with him many, many years ago, maybe 25 or 30 years ago. He came up and worked with our orchestra, and I think we had a book he'd written. Like I kind of knew, and some of his music, and yeah, just like his presence. It was really, really cool.
Yes.
And the last song on that album, Sleep, Sleep, Beauty Bright, is such a beautiful lullaby.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, those poems, and I hate when I hear other people say this, but I realize that one day I'm going to have to say this phrase. A lot of those poems sang themselves. They really did. I mean, the majority of the poems were songs of innocence, songs of experience. So a lot of them were written in stanzas, clearly, that he meant to sing. So I felt, you know, a lot of them just kind of flowed as we were reading them. And I love melody, you know, just being, you know, raised in Appalachia as a little kid, I felt like I just love melody. And I think that's the most beautiful part about the music of Appalachia, all the folk music coming out of there, is I think you get a sense of a strong sense of melody and storytelling. And when you look at like all the greats, you know, Dolly Parton and, you know, folks like that, that's what you hear in country music. You hear an incredible story and wonderful, memorable melodies.
Sleep, sleep, beauty bright, dreaming o'er the joys of night. Sleep, sleep, in thy sleep, little sorrow, sit and weep. Sweet babe, in thy face, soft desires I can trace, secret joys and secret smiles. Little pretty infant wiles. Has that song.
So, Martha, your musical career took a bit of a turn, like a conscious turn at a certain point. You were doing different music and then you decided to change.
Yeah, I sang a lot of soul music and a lot of rhythm and blues, and I still do. It's still in all of my concerts. I also found that the music, you know, these categories that people get paid a lot of money to box in, also changed. You know, you don't really hear a lot of live rhythm and blues music on the radio. You just don't hear that. You hear a lot of influences with hip hop. You know, hip hop is now become commercialized, you know, and has taken over an R&B sound. Maybe it's become, they even have something I believe called urban, you know, sound. And so I personally felt that I had a bigger, wider, broader story to tell and to share. And I don't really like being boxed into categories. I mean, I have a knee-jerk reaction. It's probably because of my own family history. You know, I don't really like having to stick to something. And I believe, you know, your life as an artist, when you're an artist, part of being an artist is to explore and to push beyond the boundaries that are given. You're supposed to create art that makes people think, you know, about themselves and their own position in the world. And I want to honor that. And so I've always been, even as when I was singing, like right on out, soul girl music, it was still something, always something different, because I had a different story to tell. When Aaron and I were writers, songwriters signed with Warner Chapel Music, we were sent a lot of artists to write and produce for. And I remember some of the folks at the publishing company would say, oh, if you want lyrics with, and hey, we'll send a pop girl over to work with us. If you want lyrics with integrity, oh, you got to go to Martha Redbone. You know, so it won't be, you know, so much like sexual innuendos, like so many things were at that particular time. You know, so it was these kind of lyrics with integrity. I remember them saying that. I thought, okay, sure, you know. But I wanted to just always tell a bigger story, and I wanted to follow a route of honoring my artistic endeavors. Is the best way to put it. I didn't want any rules around me. And as you get older, you know, as an artist, you have different things that happen in your life that resonate, that you want to celebrate and that you want to share. And then, you know, we became parents. I became a mother. Who knew that I was ever going to become a mother? I had no intention of becoming a mom. Sometimes I was one of the people on the airplanes when I saw people walk on with babies, I'd be like, oh, I hope they're not sitting next to us. And then, you know, all these years later, I turn around and, you know, Aaron and I sat on the plane with our baby and we're like, we're those people, you know, but you change and you have to honor it. You have to honor it. You can't live in the past and stay in these tiny boxes that limit you in any way creatively, I think. And writing music for theater, which brought us to Bone Hill and Black Mountain Women. And we're working on these other pieces as well. Human, a puppet, an exploration through puppetry with Nefri Ameni, and that's through the Chelsea Factory as well. And also the she's working out of the Victory Theater in Broadway. And so we wanted to make music on a broader platform that told a bigger story, and it celebrates the arc of everything that we know in music. So from classical to blues to soul to R&B to folk to rock to everything, you know. And we can find ways to dig in deep without any boundaries of making music.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you about, you know, transmitting the culture of your ancestors and how you learned some of that growing up.
Well, my grandparents were very old fashioned. We never went anywhere. We weren't really allowed to do very much. They were quite strict, and they were old time. You know, these were old traditional mountain people, and with that comes old traditional mountain everything. You know, my grandma cooked different foods that a lot of people didn't eat, you know, other families that we knew in the area didn't eat, you know. So, you know, things like what we would call like wild onions and eggs, you know, for example, like that's something that, you know, I guess that would be like the equivalent to I guess scallions. It would be scallions and scrambled eggs together, like mixed together, things like that. There was, you know, quilting. And, you know, it's interesting because when you're growing up with your grandparents, you know, you don't have a label. This is just your family, you know, so you're not, you know, I was not being taught per se, like, you are, you know, Native, you are Chickamauga, Cherokee, we are, you know, it's not a label like that. You just exist, you know, and these are, someone passes away, this is what you do. It's not because we are this. It was never given a label, you know, it just was not that type of thing. I learned later as a teenager, you know, being in New York City, you know, my mom said, oh, this is what that is, you know, because I didn't know. When we moved to our neighborhood, you know, our neighborhood was Caribbean and Latino, you know, mostly Puerto Rican and Dominican and Caribbean people from the West Indies. And so I remember being the new girl on the block and they were the girls, the Puerto Rican girls were asked speaking to me in Spanish, you know, the black girls were talking to me and, you know, and, you know, playing jump rope. They taught me how to do double Dutch. And then the Puerto Rican girls came to me and they surrounded me and they said, and they're speaking to me in Spanish and I had no idea what they were saying. And I still remember it to this day. And they said, you know, do you speak Spanish? And I said, no. You're not Puerto Rican? Are you Dominican? You know, and I didn't know what they were talking about. I'd never heard of these places. I'd just come from Kentucky. I never heard of these faraway places. And I said, no, I don't know. And they said, well, we don't talk to them. And they were talking about the black girls who were across the street because I was being friendly with both. We don't talk to them and they don't talk to us. So you're going to have to choose who you want to be with. You want to be with them, hang out with them, or you want to hang out with us? You know, and it was like one family of like five girls. And I thought, wow, I was surrounded and I had to make a choice and I didn't know either of them, you know. And so I ended up being like an outsider because I thought, well, I'm not going to hang out with either of you then if that's the way you are. I don't want to be a part of it. So I got myself out of that. And I remember coming home when my mom came home from work. I said, Mom, I said, are we Dominican? Are we Puerto Rican? And I said that, you know, when we sing our prayers, you know, at the funeral, I said, are we speaking Spanish? Is that Spanish? You know, I did not know. And my mom was like, oh, no, that's Chalagi. And I was like, what? And I said, well, what is that? And she says, oh, no, that's our old language, you know. And that's how I found out what that label was. So it wasn't, you're not given this label of this is who you are and this is the history of what happened and the removal and this kind. It was not that kind of thing. You would hear, you know, phrases, you know, little phrases here and there from my grandmother might say, oh, yeah, well, that was on the long walk. That's when those people went on the long walk, or we're going across the mountain to this, or we're making this quilt, or we're doing this and we're singing this song. So it was like that. It wasn't given a label. I didn't really know what that was per se. You know, the songs that we were taught were just songs that you would hear, you know, that's what happens before you leave the house. You sing a song. It's, you know, it's a particular song that you sing. You know, and when people arrive or a baby is born, you know, here's a lullaby that we knew that we always sang, you know, that's just that kind of thing.
Okay. That's beautiful.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes I've linked directly to this one, which I think may interest you, with Tasha Warren, Shakura Saida, Chuck Kopanas, Jamila, and Van Black. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money personally and lots of time. Please support the series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, notebooks, mugs, and more, everything printed on demand. On my Ko-fi page, you can buy me one coffee or every month. You'll also find the link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Finally, if you're finding this episode interesting, please text it to a friend. Thanks.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit towards your musical influences growing up, because you were with your maternal grandparents in Appalachia.
Yes. As a kid in Harlan County, we had one radio station. So that's why we know everything. And it's interesting because, you know, a lot of our band members are also from the Midwest. They're from Chicago and Kentucky, with roots in Kentucky as well. And it's the same thing when you're in the Midwest or Minnesota. Some of our friends are, you know, you had one major station that played everything. So we knew a Conway Twitty song, and we also knew Parliament Funkadelic, because all these songs were played, and we knew, you know, Foreigner and 10cc and, you know, the Beatles. We knew everything. And on Sundays they would play gospel music in the mornings, so we knew all of those hymns and you know, the Blind Boys of Alabama and you know, James Cleveland choirs and you know, local choirs from churches that were in the region and, you know, in the Tri-Cities. And so we knew that's how we grew up. You know, we had watched Hee Haw on TV. And so we just had a really broad sense of what music means and musical styles. And I feel really grateful for that. I also appreciate now that there are many different radio stations that you can just listen to the type of music that you want to hear. I think there's some joy in that as well. But growing up, you do in these small regions, you get this spread of everything, which I think gives you a greater sense of appreciation of all styles of music. You don't have to like everything, but it's just part of what's inside of you subconsciously.
We talked earlier about your work for Carnegie and teaching these social dances, these stomp dances. So were you dancing with your community? Was there any of that?
No. These are songs, you know, my grandpa sang. These are songs that, you know, I picked up along the way in regions. No, it wasn't that. We were in a small, very small coal mining town, and my grandparents were very old, very, very old fashioned. But in the region, you would hear in our town, you would hear, and even now, after supper, you'll hear somebody bring out a fiddle, you'll hear something like that, and someone will bring out a guitar or banjo, or you'll hear people sing. But it wasn't, these particular traditional social dances were just melodies that we sang, you know, as little kids.
Okay. Now, I was curious about the indigenous aspect with the vocables, if that was something you were hearing as a kid.
No, the vocables come from, you know, my grandpa would sing a lot of different things, and, you know, they went hunting a lot, and you would hear them hollering certain things, and that meant what they caught, you know, if they were able to catch squirrels, if they caught groundhog, if they, you know, went off and went fishing, there were all different things like that. And so just me being musical, I ended up just picking up these things along the way. And then, you know, working with other folks from the southeastern regions, I ended up learning, and they taught me songs, and then I taught them, oh, well, that sounds similar to our work songs, or that sounds similar to our, you know, dance songs. Oh, we had something that sounded like that, and then you end up kind of putting that together.
Okay. Do you think you have a pretty good musical memory?
I do. That's pretty much the only thing I remember. Yes.
No, never can it be, never can it be. No, never can it be, never can it be. Can I see another's woe and not be in sorrow too? Can I see another's grief and not seek for kind relief? Can I see a falling tear and not feel my sorrow share? Can a father see his child weep nor be with sorrow filled? Can a mother sit and hear an infant groan, an infant fear? No, never can it be, never can it be. No, never can.
You spent your teens, it says in your bio, in pre-gentrified Brooklyn. So what was Brooklyn like in those years?
Well, I came back from Kentucky into middle school, and my parents had split up for good. And we ended up moving to a new neighborhood that turned into one of the crack capitals of Brooklyn overnight. Within, you know, a 2-year period, it became extremely, extremely dangerous to live. And you know, that was in the 80s. That was the, you know, kind of a crack epidemic that hit the cities, that hit all the cities across the country. And so that's why I call it pre-gentrified. And at that time, that was just the beginning of gentrification, you know, when we, and I remember there was a family who we used to go to for after school, you know, kind of like a babysitter thing. And I remember the woman saying, two men came to my door this morning when the babies were asleep, and they opened up a suitcase full of cash and said, we'll give you this money for your house. And she said, she yelled at them, you get away from my door and don't you come back here again or I'm going to call the police on you. And so she said, and she kept saying, white people are coming to our door and trying to force us out and offering us cash and suitcases. White people are coming and they're going to take our houses away from us, you know. And she kept saying that with the parents who were picking their kids up. And I was sitting there, you know, waiting for my mom to pick me up. And I'm just listening to the story. And the parents who were picking her up, they thought that she was crazy. They just kind of looked at her and thought, you know. And so she was right. She was absolutely right. Because one of those days, it was a day off school for me, and some people came and knocked on the door, and she says, oh, go and see who that is. And I opened the door to help her out, they said, yes, we'd like to talk to you. And they said, can we leave you this card? And they were attorneys and said, oh, we'd like to talk to her. And she refused to come to tell them to go away, you know. So, and eventually that whole street, somebody bought the house across the street from her, and then their friends came and bought another house from another elderly black person. And then slowly the whole block ended up being bought out. And then in turn, we see the whole area completely changed. So that's why I talk about pre-gentrified Brooklyn. There were a lot, you know, that area in Brooklyn had a lot of teachers, you know, black and Afro-Caribbean and Latino school teachers and writers in that area, and a lot of educators. And so, and it was, you know, a lot of artists as well who ended up, you know, getting pushed out and priced out and things like that. And the same story is happening today in Brooklyn. I mean, it seems like it's happening all over this country, really. But certainly in the cities, when you look at, you know, New York City, you definitely see that. You see the same thing in places in Chicago and Detroit and, you know, all big cities. That's what's happening.
Yeah, in Canada as well. You have a new project honoring the work of bell hooks.
Yes, yes. That project came about through the Apollo Theater's New Works program. I was invited to be a cohort in, I believe, 2022, something like that, just coming out of COVID. And it might have been within the first year that bell hooks passed away. And I thought it would be a fun idea to set the words of bell hooks. You know, we did it for William Blake. I thought it would be really cool to do that. And then I love the fact that she had a book of poems called Appalachian Elegy. I thought that was really important. And so we decided to work on that, plus couple of other books we thought we would look at. And we ended up with pretty much just setting the poetry from Appalachian Elegy, including the prologue, you know, one of her essays. And it ended up being a really beautiful, beautiful project. We not only got the blessing from her estate, you know, who take care of all of her works, but we also got the blessing from her sister, Gwenda, who actually came to our workshop performance of the piece, of the working piece. And it was wonderful. We had all our folks from our friends from Hopkinsville, which is her hometown, and the Pennyroyal Arts Council, who have been supporting her work, and her sister's a part of that, and they're building a learning center for in her name. And it was just a really, really beautiful project. It ended up feeling like a kind of memorial, or like a church, or like a, you know, she has a poem where she, you know, in the poem she uses, she talks about the journey of someone who is from this land, this region, who leaves their homeland for many years, and then the right to return to your homeland, and like the reclamation of that, and then the conflicting emotions that you have returning to a homeland that has a very dark history of your erasure, of wars, of racism, of real dark ugliness, but still at the same time you're conflicted, because this is also the place where all of the people that you love are laid to rest. So they're in this ground which has all this darkness and this ugliness, but yet the beauty of all the people that you love still in here. And so she talks often in her poems about this, giving the promise of resurrection, that things will be renewed, very similar to William Blake, you know, of this kind of rebirth and renewal. And I love that. So we set that to some really amazing music that we will end up recording once we finish this piece. We're going to go back and it's, we haven't premiered it yet. We're actually still in development, but I love, the response that we've been given so far has been really absolutely beautiful, beautiful. And we're looking for partners to help bring this to the next phase. We also used, had video projections from our dear friend, Attilio Rigotti, who's a wonderful filmmaker, and he does all of these animation and interactive things, and he's just absolutely brilliant. So we put these things together. But as we were doing the workshop, it ended up feeling like we actually resurrected Bell Hooks. You know, she, her spirit is alive in the room when we do these songs. So that was wonderful. It's a really fun, fun project to do.
Okay. You have another new project, another musical project with the Civilian Theater, The Sex Variants of 1941.
Yes, that's a wonderful, project as well. That's a musical. We worked with Steve Costin, who is the artistic director of Civilians, and who's also the co-playwright, and Stephen Trask, who was the composer for Hedwig and the Angry Inch, is also our co-composer team. So there's Stephen, Aaron Whitby, my partner, and myself. So the three of us are making the music for this piece. And we had a two-week run at NYU Skirball last November, and now we're fleshing it out into a full musical. That's another one that's a really interesting story. This is a book that was published in 1941 based on what they call case studies of homosexuals. At that time, it was believed to be that gay people had a mental illness. And so a woman named Jan Gay set out to prove this wrong by interviewing a bunch of women. And Jan Gay had her own story of and success in Europe with, she was a nudist. And so she made a film, a short film, and had some success in Europe, and I believe in Germany. And so she thought it would be, she teamed up with another man named Thomas Painter, who interviewed men, gay men. So she interviewed gay women. She interviewed 40 women. He interviewed 40 men, and they put together these case studies, and then someone else kind of took over, and it's basically the sex variance is the story of how this book was made. That's how it is. And what we've done as composers is we've when you read this book tells, they're being interviewed and you can tell that they're being asked the same questions. And then they're speaking, each person, each individual is speaking in their own voice, in their own language, their own slang, whatever it is. And they're telling their stories and, you know, some of them are going back to, you know, when they were a child and then this kind of thing. And then some stories of their first encounters and that they always knew that they were gay when they were 3 years old and 5 years old. And, you know, and then these experiences through their lives, all different, unique stories. And then the person who interviewed them made their own assessments. I mean, and these were pretty harsh and objectifying and really not nice, not good, measuring their body parts and criticizing how they, whoever was interviewing them, criticizing how they felt the person looked, you know, if a person was unattractive or something, you know, they would put things like that. And so it was a really cold way of approaching people. And so we decided to make these people who were case studies, so you know, quote unquote case studies, to turn them back into human beings with feelings and a heart and some vulnerability and really listen to their words. So that's what we did, and that's what we're working on now.
That sounds like a beautiful project. How did you come to it?
We worked with the civilians. We met Steve Cawson through Les Waters, who's our director at Black Mountain, with Black Mountain Women at the Public. And the civilians, he's worked with civilians for many, many years. And they were honoring Les at their annual gala. And as we were working with Les, with Black Mountain Women, they invited us to create a song based on interviews, because it's investigative theater, the civilians theater, based on interviews about Les. So they gave us these transcripts and we turned them into songs.
Okay. Would you be comfortable talking a little bit about your working relationship with Aaron, because he's your partner in life and also creative partner?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's my dear husband, and I kind of gush about him all the time, and I had to stop doing it. I had to stop doing it because, you know, this world is such a funny world. You know, sometimes you get, you know, it's an interesting thing when you're a woman in the business. You know, if you're a woman, writer, composer, anything, and you have a male partner, you know, people think you're only successful because of the male partner. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. The sexism is really comes into play. That, oh, you can't do anything, or you can't, you know, oh, so you do the lyrics and he does the music. No, we do both. Oh, but, you know, I can't tell you how many times, you know, coming up when I was younger, we'd be in the studio and everyone would just assume that, you know, I was this, you know, cute little girl in the corner just writing, you know, apples are red, the leaves are brown in the fall, you know, and then I go and sing, tra-la-la-la-la, you know, and that I was not the producer, you know, working on this desk and mixing and knowing exactly what we want and co-arranging. I never got the co part. People never understood the co part. And so, but after so many years together, I mean, we've been a songwriting team for 32 years. Because now I'm kind of, at this age, I'm in the fuck you years. Like, if you don't get it, fuck you, you know, basically. And so, we work together. We work on separate projects, but we do mostly work together. And the reason that it's worked for 32 years is because we do have complementary talents that we share. and that it works. You know, we're best friends. We've traveled through life together. Our birthdays are a day apart, which is fun. But, you know, he's a Londoner, born and raised a Londoner, you know, and I'm from Kentucky and Brooklyn. And, you know, we've been around a lot of decades and we know a lot of music between the two of us. We probably can cover just about every style and genre. You know a lot as you get older. You see a lot. You know, each decade brings you things. We're like, oh, are we at the age where almost nothing surprises us anymore when these things happen, certain things happen? But we musically, we just have always clicked. It's not that it's a walk in the park. It's not always easy. You know, there's a lot of arguing and disagreeing, and, you know, we're passionate about what we feel works and what we feel doesn't work. But there is a mutual respect for each other creatively. The interesting thing is for us is we're such a unit as a duo, and that working with Stephen Trask or another person, which we've worked with many, many other collaborators, you know, as many as like five or six people writing songs and working on things. And one would think that we were like locked in like this, but working with Stephen Trask on the Sexperience has been, it's as if we've known each other, as if the three of us have known each other since sixth grade, you know, since middle school, pretty much. It's just the easiest collaboration. We have so much fun. We laugh, we care, we change everything. We kind of, you know, it's just a really great combination.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe to close this out, if you want to reflect a little bit, like part of your life is definitely as a touring musician, which can be really challenging. So do you have sort of advice for younger artists in terms of self-care or boundaries or how you manage that?
Absolutely. For us, it may change because we do have an album that is coming out, you know, and when you have an album specifically to promote, you have to work, you know, if you have a booking agent who sends you on tour to many places, it all depends on who you're working with. But you do have to, number one, drink a lot of water because you don't always get the sleep that you need. So you have to drink a lot of water and you have to remember to laugh. You have to remember not to take yourselves too seriously, you know, because it's just music, you know, like it's not, you know, I have to have wheatgrass shots in my rider and, you know, and this fresh squeezed orange juice has to be on my thing. And I only must have, you know, yellow roses on my dressing room. And, you know, that is a bunch of BS, you know. This is about making sure that the world, in this crazy world of chaos that we're in, that your responsibility as a performer is to give the people who are investing in you by buying a ticket to your show, you are giving them as much love and care and an opportunity to forget about who they are just for the time of the show. You take them to a place where they can just forget their troubles and be healed by the medicine that you're giving these people in whatever style it is. You know, if you're playing the violin, you know, solo, that's your job, to give joy and let people forget who they are just for the time, you know, the 90 minutes or whatever it is that you're on that stage. You have to, you're the doctor, you're a healer, you're an essential worker. And it's our responsibility to heal this world. And that's the only, that's the main thing. My first, I said drink water, but I do have something that comes before that. If you're going to be a working musician, get up before noon. That's the first one. Because mornings are really nice. Mornings are really beautiful and quiet. You know, we get up, we, you know, I have a dog, so we get up early every day, you know, but getting up at 6 is really beautiful. It's a beautiful time to write. It's a beautiful time just to have your tea or your coffee and just sit and just have this quiet prayer, meditative time just to get your senses together. So carve out some time for that too. That's another really important thing.
Beautiful. Well, thanks so much for this, Martha, today. Really appreciated it.
Thank you, Leah. Thanks for having me. It's a great, great show. Thanks so much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahrosemond.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.